Hi everyone, this is our third astrology adventure. I'm going to do my best to talk a little more slowly this time, both for your sake and for my sake also. We are reading through esoteric astrology, and we are trying to make certain correlations and get the larger picture about this new approach to astrology, which is the astrology of the soul. The true astrology of the soul cannot yet be formulated, because we do not have the insight to know the exact moment at which the soul was individualized. We would have to go back either to the moon chain for many people of the more advanced sort, even to the first solar system, and at the very earliest to Lemuria, to discover the moment, the time of individualization, which may well color the quality of the soul and its relationship to its form. But what we can do is use the individual horoscope in such a way that the methods of interpreting the planets account for soul influence. Every factor in an astrological chart can be understood in terms of the ordinary personality, or it can be seen as a conduit for soul energy. And this is what we are definitely interested in doing, if we can. Let us review the second statement which we made. The Tibetan is offering us two or three statements. That astrology is essentially the purest presentation of occult truth in the world at this time, because it is the science which deals with those conditioning and governing energies and forces which play through and upon the whole field of space and all that is found within that field. When this fact is grasped and the sources of those energies are better comprehended and the nature of the field of space is correctly understood, we shall then see a far wider and at the same time more closely related horizon. Let's see here. Yeah. The relationships between individual, planetary, systemic, and cosmic entities will be grasped, and we shall then begin to live scientifically. It is this scientific living which is the immediate purpose of astrology to bring about. At present, the position of the average believer in astrology is that he is an individual of importance, at least to himself, and that he is living on that important planet, the Earth, important to humanity, and that through astrology he can discover his identity and know what he ought to do. Well, of course, this is somewhat true. To us, we are important until we are decentralized, and to humanity, the planet is important, and of course, the planet is important to the planetary logos as well, since he has to bring his planet into a condition of sacredness in which the fifth planetary initiation will be taken. Perhaps we can call it the fifth cosmic initiation. We'll get into that a little bit later. He is responsible for his planet, and humanity is responsible for itself, and we are responsible for ourselves. But if we take a much larger picture, our little planet is as a tiny speck, even in the galaxy, and certainly in the great cosmos. And our solar logos, as vast as he may be when we think of our planets and our own nature, is as a crystal, simply, to a much larger being, and I wouldn't be surprised if he is as a molecule or an atom to beings still greater. So we do want to develop this decentralized point of view. This does not mean that we do not try to observe ourselves as any student of occultism would do. We do seek to correct the energies and forces in our nature which are in the wrong pattern as far as the intention of the soul is concerned. But every once in a while it does not hurt to use the imagination to try to see as the Master sees, and I'm sure he tries to see as the Solar Logos sees and as still greater beings see. And this will serve to take us off the center of our own stage and help us play our part in a better way, a more appropriate way, with true humility. And humility has been said to be an adjusted sense of right proportion. Okay, so we want to know what we should do. I think everyone wants to know that. There are some astrologers here who possess real esoteric knowledge. He says they are few in number indeed, and only a handful of them can be found practicing at this time. Now, think about Dane Rudyar, who was a friend of Alice Bailey, and who dedicated his great initial opus, The Astrology of Personality, to Alice Bailey. And D.K. did offer him, even though he was not a member of the Arcane School, because he was a world disciple, says D.K., he did offer him the papers, the astrological papers that were coming out, because all of these books really appeared as papers first. Dane Rudyar took good advantage of those and included some important references to them in his Astrology of Personality. But when I did meet him at one point, I had an interview with him. It was, as a young astrologer, it was one of the high points of my life at the time. And at the time, I certainly confirmed that I had the sixth ray in my nature. Anyway, I asked him about the Bailey astrology, the Tibetan's astrology, and he said, well, it's not astrology as I know it, which, of course, was a very studied response, which I'm sure he had given to many people over the years when they asked about his relationship with the Bailey astrology. But he was one of the few astrologers who possessed real esoteric knowledge. Once I asked Marcia Moore, who was really a fine astrologer, I met her about 40 years ago back at an astrological conference, and I asked her, well, who practices esoteric astrology? And she said, as far as I know, Dane Rudyar is the most esoteric astrologer that I know. So that was an eye-opener to me, and he certainly took astrology in his own direction, but he did not specifically use the Bailey system, but he did possess real esoteric knowledge. And since DK tells us that there were no initiate astrologers when he was writing, then to be an astrologer who possesses esoteric knowledge is not the same as to be an initiate astrologer, which is still higher. Now, by initiate astrologer, did he mean someone who had taken the third initiation? I don't know. Because when he said, gave the reason why Dane Rudyard was not a member of the groups that he was starting, he said because he is a world disciple. And a world disciple is an initiate of the third degree. So there are some things here to straighten out. So only a handful can be found practicing at this time. The modern investigator likes to believe that on him impinge and through him flow all those energies which come from the sign in which the sun finds itself at the time of his birth. Well, I do think there are solar energies which pass through that section of the aura, or loon, as it's called, just like a section of an orange. I do believe there are solar energies which pass through those particular loons, or magnetic devic aspects of the aura. And so the sun, in a way, finds itself in those signs, because when looking through that section of the Earth's magnetic field, you would see the sun. But of course, the particular loon, L-U-N-E, is not correlated with the stars which you would see behind the sun. Once it was, some 2,000 years ago, correlated, and if you looked through the auric section of the zodiac, which is called Aries, you would see the sun, and behind it, if you could eliminate the blinding light, you would see the constellation Aries. But that is no longer the case, and will not be the case for another maybe 23,900 years. So the average, the modern investigator, and of course so many people interested in astrology are not investigators at all, they are simply interested. They don't go into the matter in any scientific, studential manner. But those who do regard themselves as responsive to the forces of the various planets as they govern the houses in his horoscope. And he, the modern investigator, believes that his life trends and circumstances are thus determined. Well, they are certainly indicated. They are conditioned. But remember, we discussed the difference between that which governs and that which conditions and influences. So these trends and circumstances may not at all be determined, but there are a certain flow of possibilities which tend to occur, and then the individual, depending upon the degree of his soul focus and mental control, can direct these circumstantial flows in the, according to his own mind and vision and destiny. So this makes the individual feel himself to be a factor of isolated importance. Well, there is the illusion immediately. We have the factor of ahamkara. Ahamkara is this principle of I-ness, which seems to condition human consciousness increasingly from the time of individualization. If you look at the word isolated, you will see the influence of the Sun and Leo in their lower meanings, in the way they impact the human being from a lower perspective. So we oftentimes think of ourselves as isolated individuals, but if we think deeply about what we are, how we are sustained, what we in-breathe and what we express, we shall see that all manner of energy flows coming from all possible directions and forms prove that isolation is an illusion. One of the great problems of evil in the world today, and Leo is considered in some ways a very materialistic sign when it is expressed in a lower manner, and a sign related to the Black Lodge, one of the great problems is egoism, or egotism. Egoism is the philosophy of the isolated individual, believing that he is a reality. And egotism is the selfish result of that egoistic philosophy or belief. So there are times when we may feel isolated, but the ageless wisdom will help us see the relationships of the unit of energy that we are, the relationship between the unit of energy that we are and the many other units of energy in our immediate vicinity and far beyond our vicinity as well. So modern interpretations, he says, fail to emphasize the importance of the rising sign, the ascendant. Now, you know, at the 9 o'clock position, if you look at the horoscope as a clock with 12 hours, we find the point at which the ecliptic and the horizon intersect. That point is all important in astrology and depends very much upon the exact moment of your birth. And that point is one of the most spiritual points in the horoscope and is the conduit for soul energy, although there are other ways to interpret it as well. It is for the person who has no soul contact of a conscious kind, it certainly cannot be interpreted as the main conduit of soul energy, because the person is simply not aware. But for the awakening individual, the higher meaning of the ascendant is the energy which impels us in the direction that the soul on its own plane, or the solar angel, would have its personality achieve in a particular life. So the reason that he says that the rising sign has not been much emphasized in astrology is because very few, the fact that only a few, have been as yet ready to function as souls. Now there are many, you know, the rising sign also has a very material meaning. It can indicate very much the nature of the physical body, and it has a lot to do with one's lower sense of identity. And some of the astrologers who are not into the esoteric aspect of the science have called it the mask of the identity. In other words, they consider that the sun sign is the true identity and that the rising sign is simply a mask. Well, if the rising sign indicates the physical mechanism and pretty much the personal vehicles, one can see how it would be a mask for the sun, since the sun is said to represent the personality. However, like the rising sign, The sun also has a number of different meanings, all the way from very physical to very spiritual. It is, after all, a star. He goes on to say, small allowance has been made for the energies which play upon our planet all the time from other constellations, or from the many hidden planets. Now, by the other constellations, we're not only talking about the zodiacal constellations. We are talking about the some 36 classical constellations, which Alice Bailey discusses in her book, The Labors of Hercules. And interestingly, three of these constellations are associated with every sign of the zodiac, or rather with every constellation. So let's just say if you're looking at Scorpio, you will have the serpent constellation, you will have Ophiuchus, the serpent handler, and you will also have Hercules. And all of these are part of the Scorpio experience. And now, modern astronomers have named perhaps 88 or more constellations going beyond the original 36. So this naming of constellations is very much coming from the mind of man and his projections of his own psyche into the sky. There are even constellations which represent man-made instruments like telescopes, for instance, and there are others as well. About the hidden planets, I would like to refer to a quotation from Master DK. I have that in another document. Here we are learning that there are approximately 70 hidden planets in our solar system, but if we are a little more careful, and now I'm going to go to another reference. Pardon the rapidly moving text. We will see here that there are as many as 115, more than 115, and of course that number 115 is a little suspicious. Is it a symbolic number? Because it is divided into two ones and a five, which is exactly how you divide the seven planes. The logoic plane is esoteric, the monadic plane is esoteric, that's the one and the one, and the next five are the Brahmic planes, beginning with the Atmic plane, Atma, Atmic, Buddhic, Manasic, Astral, and Etheric Physical. But anyway, more than 115 planets hidden. And some may be hidden because they are etheric in nature, and some may simply be densified planets and not yet discovered. So let's see what DK says about this in an excerpt from A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. The true figures in connection with any planetary scheme and its occult activity are not ascertainable by the man who cannot be trusted with the significance of the other planetary bodies of great number within the solar ring pass knot. It's almost as if we have to learn something about the lower lives, of which we know very little right now, before we can be trusted with the true significance of the normal planetary schemes, especially the sacred ones, and even the synthesizing schemes, which are sacred but have even greater spiritual status. So let's just say it is probably likely that we will learn a great deal more about Mars and Pluto as non-sacred planets before we learn the full depth of the meaning of Mercury, of Venus, and Vulcan, and so forth. We know something about them, but there are mysteries concealed in their nature. So we're not going to be given the true numbers, the true figures, and the planetary lore is going to be somewhat denied to us. Now, he goes on, the other planetary bodies of great number within the solar ring pass not. The entire solar sphere is full of such bodies, characterized by the same features as are the seven and the ten. There, I think, we're talking about seven including non-sacred planets and the ten including synthesizing planets. But actually, there are probably, he tells us, 12 major planets, of which five will be non-sacred and seven will be sacred. And each of these other bodies in the solar system has the same types of principles and vehicles, and each of them has an effect upon the whole. So we are really not playing with a full deck of cards here. Figures, therefore, cannot be considered as final until the effect of the lesser planetary bodies upon their immediate neighbors is known, and the extent of their planetary radiation has been gauged. Well, this is certainly a task for the Aquarian Age, when the science of subtle energies will be keenly developed, but we have to pass through the last stages of the veils, materialistic veils of the Piscean Age. You'd normally think, well, Pisces is a very refined and sensitive and tenuous and ethereal sign, and that's completely true for the higher aspects of its nature. But it is not true for the lower type of response which forms give to the Piscean energy. The very first keynote of Pisces, go forth into matter. Go forth into matter. So it can be extremely veiling and materialistic. Now the point here, there are more than 115 of such bodies to be reckoned with. And all are at varying stages of vibratory impulse, meaning they have their own evolutionary status, their own rays, which will be most interesting. They have definite orbits. They turn upon their axis. They draw their life and substance from the sun. But owing to their relative insignificance, they have not yet been considered factors of moment. Well, you kind of wonder whether the planetoids per se, which orbit around a planet while that planet is orbiting around the sun, are included here, or if only those planets which are actually in their own right orbiting around the sun and have their own specific orbit. Suffice it to say, what an amazingly complex, veiled solar system we live in at this time. And we can extrapolate this kind of knowledge. There are so many non-sacred, relatively insignificant planets in our solar system. Why should there not be a great number of non-sacred, relatively insignificant stars in particular constellations, of which we may perhaps see only the most luminous stars that are related? So we do have to distinguish very greatly between the sacred and developed planets and those which have a long way to go before they reach their status. The principle of hierarchy operates all through nature, and planets have their own hierarchy. Stars, stellar beings, have their own hierarchy. Constellations have their own hierarchy, and I'm sure one day it will be proved that, let's stop with galaxies, although we could go on, that galaxies themselves have their own hierarchy, and that there are galaxies of lesser and greater development. So DK goes on, after describing these 70 or more than 115 planets, all with their own principles, their own psyche, their own ray energies, their own influence, he goes on to say, I desire to give you a truer and more accurate picture. This has now become possible because group awareness, group relations, and group integrity are coming to the fore of human consciousness. I suppose we correct each other by our differing points of view within the group. In other words, the group always knows more than the individual, if the group is composed of similar individuals. As this takes place, the personality, which is individual, separative, and self-centered, will recede increasingly into the background, and the soul, non-separative, group-conscious, and inclusive, will come more and more to the fore. Well, I believe he here is talking about the selfish, integrated personality, which is not soul infused. The instrument that we call the soul infused personality is still very important, and we have to cultivate it even up until the fourth initiation. But there is a stage earlier in which the personality, for a series of, he describes it, three lives, seven lives, sometimes even 11 lives, is very much selfishly integrated around its own mental center, and is not responsive to the more inclusive influences of the ego, with a capital E, on its own plane. So, because we are beginning to respond more as souls, and souls are group conscious, the astrology of the soul can now make its impression upon us. Not the full astrology of the soul, of course, but at least an understanding of how the individual horoscope can be used in order to indicate how soul influence can reach that personality. The soul is group conscious, and the heart, which is the major organ of the soul at this time, is a transpersonal organ, and it is an organ which reveals group consciousness. And when I speak about the organ, I'm speaking about the the heart chakra per se, on all of its different levels, which are astral, and also even higher mental in terms of the egoic lotus. Interest, therefore, in the individual horoscope will gradually die out. Well, so much depends upon the meaning of the word gradually. The individual horoscope is very much with us at the present time, and it serves to help people understand how they can adjust their energies to the plan which they as a soul are holding for a particular incarnation. So I would say that before the individual horoscope dies out, we have to perfect the interpretation of the individual horoscope and show how this horoscope can be useful in revealing the destiny of the soul for any particular incarnation. So gradually, perhaps sometime during the Aquarian Age, which will be a great group age, we will see how this may fade from human consciousness, but the time is certainly not yet. And he says, increasingly, the planetary, the systemic, and the universal picture will stand out in the awareness of the individual. Well, all of us as monads are cells within one of the chakras of the planetary logos, so that when we become initiates of the sixth degree, we will truly be planetary lives. We will be monads in full expression. And when we think of our identity, we will think much more of the planet as a whole, rather than of some individual personality or even individual egoic body, which by then will have faded away. We also can develop eventually the solar systemic point of view. That's a long way away. Perhaps we would have to be initiates of the seventh degree to do that in the proper manner. Then there's the question of the universal picture. Now, sometimes our little solar system is referred to as a universe. It's a very small meaning of the term. But I like to think of it as a much more cosmic picture. And when I think of the greatest of all beings, that all-inclusive one being of our entire cosmos, I like to call that being the universal logos. Then, for me, the universe means all possible manifestation on all planes, and all-inclusive. Okay, so, and already we are becoming interested in this greater planetary, systemic, universal picture. DK is nurturing us in this, and in some ways, people shy away from this book because the picture it presents is too big. They really want to focus on the person and his immediate problem, and that is a very legitimate approach. But from a higher perspective, that person is but a cell in a larger entity, which the person in his true identity actually is. The larger identity in which we are that cell is our truer identity, and on we will find that our true identity gets bigger all the time and more inclusive all the time. There are some people who can say, "I am humanity," and they can mean it, and they know what it means. There are some who can say, "I am the planet," and they know what that means. And eventually, very high beings will be able to say, "I am the solar system." The word individual is interesting because it is somewhat related to the idea of indivisible. So it has a kind of a contradictory meaning to the way it is usually used. The true individual, or the true indivisible, is the being who knows that he is all those other beings who appear within his contents of consciousness. But for now, we use the term individual as that which is divided and distinct from others of its kind. We use it in the lower Leonian sense. So when this greater expansion of interest occurs, and the interest in the personality and even in the ego on the higher mental plane dies out, he will then regard himself only as an integral part of a far more important whole. And his world group will interest him far more than himself as an individual. That is already, would we not say, that is already the ashramic perspective. When a person is a true, I'm going to try to get the glare off my glasses, sorry about that. I can't really do it. Okay, well, blinded by the light. All right. When a person is a true member of an ashram, His spiritual identity is invested in that ashram. And his eyes are not upon himself only as an individual, but the individual that he is seen as the instrument and expression of the ashram. We have to move towards that state of consciousness, which is certainly far more inclusive than the one we normally live in. And the new astrology is meant for individuals who can move beyond, as I've called it before, the skin-encapsulated ego. Really move beyond that. And that is possible as we suffer, as we experience pain, as we become more sensitized, then we can no longer shut the rest of the world out because what it feels is what we feel, and then we discover that we are it. So that sensitization leads us into soul consciousness, where the new astrology will be useful. DK goes on and says something very disappointing to some people. He says, "I shall not, therefore, deal with the subject of the esoteric astrology from the standpoint of the horoscope at all." Well, you know, he does a little bit. He tells us a little bit about the houses of the horoscope, and he even encourages us to devise spiritual meanings for the houses of the horoscope. So each one of them can be interpreted on at least two levels. He gives us the first two, house number one and house number two, and then he says, "Now you go on and you do the rest." So in a way, he does reference the horoscope obliquely in various places, but he's certainly not involved in that kind of, tell me all about myself, individual astrology that so many of us can't help but be interested in at a certain point in our lives until we outgrow it, if we ever do. So anyway, he tells us universal relationships, let's call them cosmic. The interplay of energies, how they all affect each other and combine, meaning different things in combinations. The nature of what lies behind the great illusion. The deluding appearances of things as they are. What a magnificent definition for the great illusion. And the destiny of our planet, of the kingdoms in nature, and of humanity as a whole. These will constitute the major part of our theme. Well, I don't think he's dealing with what lies behind the universe, considered as the great illusion. We're in the Mahamaya, the universe itself, considered by the highest seers, is itself an illusion. But he's talking about the local great illusion. The illusion that everything revolves around the earth, that the sun actually moves when it is we who are doing the moving, that the stars do not move, that they maintain their fixed position. See, in the old days they were called the fixed stars because the only kind of equipment that man had was his naked eye. And he did not know about their proper motion. He did not know how far the constellations, the stars in a particular constellations, really are from each other. He did not know that light had a certain rate of speed, and that when we look at Sirius, we're looking at a star as it was 8 years ago. But then when we look at the three accompanying stars, which seem, well, relatively bright compared to Sirius, they are all in the constellation of the dog, greater dog, when we look at them, we're looking at where they were 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. So the configuration of the stars as constellations is itself an illusion depending upon our point of observation. In other words, it doesn't really exist. The ideal observer, who could see all things at the same time, would not see the constellations as we do. Yet, I must say, the fact that we do see them as we do, and that they create the figures in the sky as they do, is significant for us, and the influence of their energy as it reaches us does relate to these configurations. In other words, let's say the Big Dipper or the Great Bear means something to us because of where we are, and it does fulfill that kind of function of the wagon, of the dipper, of the bear. It fulfills all those functions. If we were to look upon this aggregation of stars from a completely different point of view, it would not look like any of those figures, and for the observer who was looking upon them, it would have the meaning of the configuration that he saw. So this is rather mysterious. It shows that there are illusions, but the illusions actually convey effective energies which are allied to the nature of the illusion. So what the Great Bear is fully and completely to our solar system and our local cosmos may be quite different from what it is to an observer completely in a different position in space. Yet after all, there is an essential meaning to each of these aggregations of stars. A friend of mine who was scientifically inclined once said, well, you know, they're not really constellations at all, it's just appearances. But then I pointed out to him, or it was evident, that DK does see these aggregations as related stellar entities who have a lord working through all of them. The lord of the constellation Aries, the lord of the constellation Libra, and so forth. So exactly how these stellar entities are related to each other and why and what is their history, okay, we may not know that. We won't know that yet, and maybe even the great astrologers in the hierarchical department of astrology, maybe even they don't know all of that. But one day we will know these things. We have nothing but beings in relationship with each other, according to the quality that they manifest. So, first of all, we have to understand the quality of a being in apparent space, and then we have to understand why that being relates to another being with a different quality, and what is served by that relationship. You know, we can bring it down to our own level. We have friends that are very different from the way we are. We are as we are, they are as they are, but the relationship between us has its own quality. And if another person is brought into the picture, then each will have his own distinct identity, but the relationship of the threesome will have its own quality, whereas the relationship of any two within that triple unity will have a distinct and different quality. So it's all about what we're studying here is the great science of relationships. Now DK goes on, boy, are we making progress already, page 7. I think at this rate, especially if I talk more slowly, which certainly prevents my tongue from getting ahead of my mind, that we'll be here until the year 2025. I think that would be a conservative estimate. Well, DK goes on to say, it is immaterial to me whether modern astrologers accept or reject these presented ideas. Well, it isn't that he doesn't expect them to be accepted. He knows in time they will be. He certainly hopes that modern astrologers will experiment with what he's talking about. But he knows the reality of crystallized thought forms, and it sometimes takes people a long time to work their way beyond conventional astrology without necessarily rejecting it into the esoteric field. I've seen Some people rebuff it entirely. Some people manage to reach tentatively towards it, and they discover real wonders, and yet they manage to keep the bridge between the conventional astrology and the new astrology, the new astrology they are discovering. So he says, I will endeavor to give you certain facts as the hierarchy recognizes them. Well, okay, we have to trust DK here. He's tremendously responsible in giving us the gems of the ageless wisdom. So even though we may not realize that what he is saying is factual, we have to decide whether we will believe him or not. I just want to say, actually, today is Moria Remembrance Day, March 24th. I just, you know, lest I forget, I wanted to say that to everybody. The Master Moria said that if you want to remember me on March 24th. I'm sure he has his own reasons for saying that, but I believe he is very identified with the sign Aries in some respect. Okay, so Master DK is giving us certain facts as the chiefs, as the hierarchy recognizes them. I will indicate, he says, if I can, because our minds are pretty thick, the subjective potencies of which the outer illusion is but the phenomenal appearance, conditioned by men's thoughts throughout the ages. So he's going to take us deeper behind appearances. He's not discounting appearances, because of course we must study the garment of God. We must do that, and we have to learn how it works on that particular phenomenal level. But the esotericist is interested in causes, and one of the best ways of determining causes rather than effects is to study the science of astrology. So he's telling us that the phenomenal appearance is certainly conditioned by what we think. In other words, as we think it, so it becomes. Thoughts tend to manifest. When we change our thoughts, the manifestation will change. And when we change our thoughts in accordance with the archetypes, which are meant to materialize in the lower worlds, then our thoughts will convey those archetypal energies, and we will have a new world. Okay. I will emphasize the fact of the livingness of the sources from which all the energies and forces which play upon our planet flow and emanate. Well, when the modern astronomer looks out in space, he analyzes the planets according to his knowledge of chemistry and physics, but most, not I will not say all, but most do not suspect that there is a great psyche behind each one of these planetary, stellar, constellational, galactic beings. The psychic element is missing. The true being and the consciousness of that being is missing. So DK is going to say, look, these are more than third aspect demonstrations. They're not just material energies, many of which the modern astronomer doesn't even suspect. They are living beings within one living being, and that one living being, the ultimate one, can even be called space, with all capital letters. So he says, I will endeavor above all else to demonstrate to you that all-pervading unity and that underlying synthesis which is the basis of all religions and of all the many transmitted forces. So certainly science and religion are going to be brought together through the study of astrology, which is the study of the many gods within the one God. Synthesis is the key at this time. The great being called the Avatar of Synthesis is overshadowing our planetary logos, and all of us are inclined in our thought to think in terms of wholes and great aggregations. Well, such thinking may be a positive thing, or it can also be the attempt to force a totalitarian system upon one's fellow human beings. But anyway, we are thinking in larger terms. I will seek to remove you, he says, as individuals from out of the center of your own stage. Very Leo and dramatic, isn't it? And consciousness. And without depriving you of individuality or of self-identity, yet, And without depriving you of your individuality and of self-identity, yet show you how you are a part of a greater whole of which you can become consciously aware when you function as souls, but of which you are today unconscious, or at least only registering and sensing the inner reality in which you live and move and have your being. So we're just at the very threshold of the wholeness which the soul perceives, and which even now, as a soul, we perceive. You know, we do, I think, have multi-dimensional consciousness, and we are conscious on various levels simultaneously, but the lesser phase of our consciousness is not automatically conscious of what the greater phase of consciousness experiences. I want to go to, he wants to have us keep our individuality and our self-identity. So I have another kind of a excerpt from the Rays and the Initiations, which hopefully I can find. Here's something on the etheric planets that I didn't discuss, but there are many hidden and etheric planets, Cosmic Fire 794. And now, I'm going down a little farther. All I have to do is find it. It is here. Yes, coming. Well, if I were going to edit these, I would edit this out. But I'm getting this out to you as soon as I can. And therefore, you'll have to make do. Yes, here it is. Okay. Oh, all right. 20 seconds later. This is why DK wants us to be able to keep our sense of individuality and identity, as well as our sense of wholeness. So he tells us that in the state of being which we call the monadic, no difference is recognized between these two, if I can bring such ideas down to the level of the intelligence of the aspirant, because it is realized that there is no identity apart from universality, and no appreciation of the universal apart from the individual realization. Rays and the Initiations, page 106. So this is very worth pondering. We are, our true identity is universal, and we realize it. But the individual, the unit, is the one who recognizes that the identity is truly universal. So what we have is the concept here of the great whole and the point. The point has no dimensions, and yet it is. It is, in a way, the symbol of the individual. It exists, and yet it does not exist. The whole universe, I think, is but a point. So ponder on that. I've been pondering on it for years, trying to get deeper and deeper into the meaning of it. So we're just beginning now to realize the nature of the one in whom we live and move and have our being. Well, friends, I seem to have exhausted the time allowed to me. I have spoken more slowly. I promised myself that I would do that, and I'm already almost a minute over the allotted hour. So it may one day have to be edited. I would just like all of us to take the note G, which is the soul note, the second ray note. It's also a seventh ray note from another perspective, but we will use it as a second ray note, and we will together seal our thoughts as we sound the Om together, and we will continue in our adventure number 4. These are not really webinars, as you probably realize, not yet. These are simply me talking to you instead of writing to you. Oftentimes I write, and it takes more time, perhaps it's more exact, but I thought that it would be also useful for us to just relate to each other through conversation. And we will do that later in actual webinars. For listening, and make note of your questions, and when we have some question and answer webinars, we will discuss them. Okay, bye for now.